C'est tellement nouvelle cette chanson française qu'il faut que je lis toutes les paroles parce que elle vient de la faire il y a 3 jours. Elle a seulement 3 jours. Et c'est pour ça que j'ai les paroles ici. Mais je vous promets que depuis aujourd'hui, elle va être très populaire en France. Vous voyez. Je pense. La mer.
Should I record locally too?
You know what? We never have, I don't think. We've survived.
I'm superstitious.
If you want to, please do.
Now that I've offered, if I don't do it, something's going to go wrong.
Of course, if I say no, then it won't work. So please go ahead.
All right, I'm doing that.
All righty.
Do I sound normal?
You sound great. Yeah, great. You sound normal to me.
Sorry that I'm going to have this microphone in front of my face.
No.
It's fine.
I kind of have to move mine away from my face because everyone tends to, my spouse mainly, tell me I'm very loud. So if I get too loud, someone just tell me. All right. Hello and welcome to another episode of Tinker Tailor Podcast Spy, your very infrequent podcast about John le Carré books, movies. There are at TV shows, I suppose. We got TV lots shows, of TV shows. We
radio, the Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy radio show is good too.
We should do some of those at some point in 10 years.
So this
is Tyler speaking. I'm here with my regular co-host Max.
Hello.
And we have a special guest today, Sam Adler Bell. Hello, Sam.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
No problem.
Thanks
Sam
for coming.
Is a writer, and specifically we'll be talking to him a little bit about some of his John le Carré focused writing, but just a great writer in general. I mean, you can find Sam's work all over the place. The two le Carré pieces of his that I know about, maybe there's more. There was one in The Baffler last year, I think, that was really, really interesting and good. And then there was one that just came out recently in The Times, which we're going to get to in a minute. But Sam also hosts a really great podcast with his co-host Matt Sittman called Know Your Enemy, which is about the right, and a very, very interesting podcast if you want to learn about the right from a left-wing perspective, and I guess a right-wing perspective. I think that's fair to say.
Sometimes.
But really, really interesting podcast, so please check it out. You know, all our hundreds and thousands and hundreds of thousands of listeners, please check out Sam's podcast. Okay, so first of all, like we do with any of our guests, we'll just ask you, Sam, quickly. You are very well read in John le Carré. If people read your article, and I think you've shoved down enough le Carré that you're probably done for one lifetime. But what is your history with him as a writer? When did you start reading him, et cetera?
It's interesting. I mean, I feel like I read probably my first le Carré like as a teenager, when a lot of people do, pulled off a dad's shelf or a grandfather's shelf.
Sure.
Classic dad book. And I always liked him. My mom really likes him too. Actually, probably was from her shelf. I shouldn't be lying to make myself more cliche. My mom is kind of an Anglophile and reads a lot of English literature in general. Really more recently, I had this experience during the pandemic, which probably some of the listeners can relate to, which was that I had a really hard time concentrating on books.
Mm-hmm.
And in the beginning of the pandemic, it was like just kind of, I think it was had to do with just being so plugged into the internet all the time, and also just the like ambient anxiety and stress of that moment. My attention constantly being pulled away, even though, you know, ironically, we had more time than ever,
right,
in principle to read. I couldn't read. And it was driving me crazy. And I kind of quite deliberately created this regimen for myself where I thought, if I can't read, you know, the kind of books I normally do, I should definitely be able to pay attention to like a thrilling
spy
novel. Sure. And because I'm a snob, I was like, well, if I'm going to do that, I should do it with John le Carré.
Right,
you know, exactly. I'm not going to read Tom Clancy.
Exactly.
See, I did read Tom. I am a bore, and I read Tom Clancy. I was like, I'm going to go back to middle school, and I read. Red
Five
Storm Cussler. Rising. Yeah.
airport dad style.
It's the same impulse,
yeah.
And I'm sure it would have worked with Tom Clancy too. But I went back to le Carré and really started I think I read Spyro Came In From the Cold first and then went back to the ones before that. And then I hadn't read, I had read Tinker Tailor, but I hadn't read the other two in the Carla trilogy. And I just devoured them and it really worked on me. Like I was able to just pay attention to these books and I got, because I wasn't reading anything else, I got like so obsessed with him. And then I read the Sisman biography. Ironically, and this will not be surprising for those of you who read my my piece in The Baffler, the other thing that I started doing during the pandemic was my girlfriend and I both started taking these classes on Sigmund Freud. At the Brooklyn Institute, like on Zoom, with Patrick Blanchfield, who's a great Freudian scholar and writer. So then once I had learned how to read again from Le Carré, the other thing I was reading was Freud. So I was just reading exclusively Le Carré and Freud, and just these things were becoming totally like enmeshed in my brain.
Yeah.
And I was just reading all of, so I was just really fixated on the way he talks about fathers and sons and kind of,
Infidelity and
and the family and inheritance and betrayal and loyalty, which are all just such rich psychoanalytic themes. But also the spy novel is such a great kind of playground to think about those things. And so even before the opportunity arose, I had started writing this essay in my head about Le Carré and The Perfect Spy, which is not the book we're talking about today, but it's a great book, and fathers and sons. And then what happened was that I guess last year they published his collection, The Collected Letters, A Private Spy. It was edited by his son. I saw that that was coming out, had this thing in my head already, and I wrote to one of my friend at The Baffler, Jess Bergman, who's also a Le Carré head, and said, like, can I write an essay about these letters, A Perfect Spy, Le Carré and Freud? And like, thank God she said yes, because like, I had literally no other thoughts. Like
you were going to write it anyway.
It was like the total, the complete, more so than anything I've written in a long time. It was just like the apotheosis of all of my thoughts for like a year of reading Le Carré.
It's a fun one. It really is. And I think the collection of letters is an interesting kind of jumping off point. Cause I think that had that just come out when you like, I think that was just coming.
Yeah. It was last September, October.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, the essay in The Baffler was in principle, it was a review of the collection of letters.
Right. Right. And many tangents. And then we've got this really cool piece that came out just super recently. When did this come out again? July 12th. And we're recording early August. So
very right recently. On top of it.
Yeah. And, you know, credit
breaking
to you.
News.
Yeah, this is breaking for Le Carré heads. Oh, and there was another Le Carré piece of news that is actually
another book.
Kind of breaking was that there's going to be a documentary by, is it Errol Morris who's doing it?
Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is Errol Morris. Yep.
So I don't
I didn't
look up any more details than that, but I mean, I'll definitely be.
I think it's supposed to be, I mean, they're framing it as secrets revealed, at least partially. So I wonder if it's delving into his his days in Bonn. Bonn. I am bad at German.
Bonn.
So, Bonn.
I feel like you can't mess up Bonn, hopefully. Bond's got to be Bond, I hope. Even if
boned.
Bone.
Boned, yeah.
So this Times piece is super interesting because you kind of categorize novels, you know, subjectively, I suppose. But I agree with the list almost wholeheartedly, I would say. So it seems a very good list where you break down books. And you read, it seems like, the vast majority, if not all, of his books over the course of the last few years. So I think you're coming from a pretty informed place. And maybe, you know, I don't want I don't want to spoil the whole article, but you know, Max, was there anything that stuck out for you as a pick that you came across and thought, yes, this is?
Can I just say for the listeners, yes. it's the New York Times Book Review does these quote unquote essential guides to different novelists, and they've done them for like Philip K. Dick, and recently they did. I don't know. They've done like Zola and anyway, a couple of different, they've done a bunch of them. I just can't think of them right now, but they asked me to do it. So the kind of conceit of the piece is I'm choosing the essential picks, which is like a hot kind of anxiety inducing task. But then when you put it together, the way that my editor encouraged me to do it was to it's not like a ranked list. It's kind of like you should say like, here's the one to start with. Like, here's the one if you're interested in X. Like, here's, you know, whatever. So that's how it is. But anyway,
I think you did. So the one thing I'll say about it is that I didn't have any major disagreements. Now, I haven't read every Le Carre novel, so maybe there's some that'll surprise me. However, all the ones you've listed here are ones that I have read. And I was glad you mentioned The Little Drummer Girl, because that one we actually did recently. I mean, this tends to happen, and I don't know if it's just one of these things where I love his books and his style, and every time I come across a book that I haven't read, I assume it can't be that good because I haven't gotten to it yet, and then I read and I love it, and I loved Little Drummer Girl. I actually thought the show was quite good as well.
Show is incredible,
but it was really well done. I thought I really enjoyed it, and
it's Park Chan-wook.
I don't think I even.
So
it's really stylistic. I think it looks really cool and well acted, and my spouse watched it with me, and I remember very well, not fondly, I remember very clearly I tried to get my mom, my dad, and her to watch a Tinker Tailor Spy movie, thinking this is gonna be it, I'm gonna blow their minds, and everyone at the end was just sitting there with a dead expression in their eyes thinking like, what happened who are any of these people, did the good guys win? But in this case, yeah, Little Drummer Girl was a hit.
The novel is great. It really is.
Yeah, I love the novel. I think it is kind of he is, I think, at his best when he's pulling from his real life, because I think Charlie is kind of supposed to be modeled after his sister, or half sister,
right?
Half sister. And you know, just you have all the books with his dad. You know, everything about his dad. He's just he is very good at pulling from real life and still putting it into a kind of thriller spy story. I do want to ask. So, I have not read yet, and. I am dying to do on the podcast. Did you read Naive and Sentimental Lover for this?
I really want it. It's not as bad as people think.
I really
hoped that it would be great and I would be able to put it on the list.
Put it on
and
the list,
all the Le Carre spy, he's only a spy writer type people. It's just not. It's not as good. And it's like, the thing is that there are elements of that. That was a pretty early book, right?
Right after A Small Town in Germany. Yeah. That was his next book.
Right. So it's kind of like, I think he got really kind of burned, you know, because he thought, okay, now I'm ready to be a serious writer of literature. So I'm going to write this book that doesn't have a spy plot. And, you know, critics hated it. And so, or most critics did. And then he kind of felt, I think, pretty chastened and went back to his grubby spy plots instead. But
like any good genre author, though, if they're talented the way he's talented, you can explore a lot of stuff with the trappings of, you know, a spy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So I
think it was good for him to do it because I think then later on he wrote, I mean, my favorite is A Perfect Spy. I think it's his best book. And that one has just as much kind of emotional sophistication, psychological sophistication as any novel, really. Right. I mean, it's a great novel. It's not just a great spy novel. Yeah. And I think that he learned a lot from working on Naive and Sentimental Lover. And there's a lot of stuff in there that then he kind of, you know, it's a book about kind of an affair, and it's really about his affair with his friend, what's his name, Kennaway, the writer, who with his wife, with his friend's wife, and there was a kind of like, you know, a kind of like wife swapping kind of vibe to the whole thing, in the sense that like, the woman who he's having the affair with would say that she felt that he was like consummating his affair with her husband through his affair with her, because really it was about their friendship. So anyway, it's like a really, those kinds of things, those kinds of infidelities and, you know, kind of weird marriage plots emerge in his later work. Just, they're just, spies are also there.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And I mean, even, you know, even the book that we're going to talk about today, which I always want to say a little town, but a small town in Germany. Yeah. I mean, we'll get into it in a bit, but one of my favorite chunks of the book is when he's just interviewing all these people. And so much of it is just learning about the histories of these people, how they've worked through all sorts of trauma within their family related to Harding, et cetera, et cetera. And that part is great. And it's the conceit is he's interviewing them to find a missing person, but they're just really interesting little character studies.
Definitely should read Naive and Sentimental Lover.
Yeah, we're going to do it. Yes. Maybe that'll kick us into gear, and maybe that'll be the next one we do as a bit of a spy break. So yeah, it's high up there.
I couldn't in good conscience put it on my list.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a probably a reason why no one has put it on their list. I'm sure people want, I think a lot of people probably wanted it to be good, right? They wanted it to be. I think a lot of people root for him just as a person, as an author. He seems, I think his style is so endearing. And whenever you see clips of him in the rare interview clips that there are with him, he just comes across as an endearing person. I think people root for him.
Okay, yeah, the one that popped out to me is, I think you're 100% right that The Looking Glass War is his most underrated book. It's an incredible book, especially how much he packs into, it's one of his shorter books too, as a lot of his earlier works are. They, I think, like with a lot of authors, tend to get longer as he as he wrote more and more, whether that's because the editors are more deferential as he becomes more famous or whatever, I'm not sure, but he packs so much into that book, and it is such an indictment of kind of the Cold War intelligence agencies. It definitely is underrated. One that wasn't on the list, not the book itself, but I think one of my favorite endings of any book was The Tailor of Panama, the book version, the book ending, not the movie ending, which does do a very Hollywood happy ending, but the ending of Tailor of Panama, where he's walking into the favela, it's getting bombed, is for a book that does have a lot of kind of, probably could have used some more editing and cut down, the ending is one of my favorites of his.
Reminded me a lot of this book in a lot of ways, the ending. I was actually thinking about the
they are
of
very
that
similar.
Book
yes.
In this book, this kind of slow, scary walk to the end.
Yeah, the sort of cinematic ending.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so one thing, Sam, actually, I want, before we get into the book proper, I just thought it'd be interesting. I was saying to you before we started recording, I was listening to a recent Know Your Enemy podcast that you guys did about manliness, is probably the best way to describe it. How to be, this is probably maybe doing a disservice, but what's the left's version of being a good man? Is there such thing? Can you do such a Herculean task as to lay that out? And you guys did a very, I thought, great job of working through the challenges of that. And maybe there is a way, maybe it's difficult, but we should try to do it in some way. And I just was thinking as I was reading through this, I think Le Carré has a very interesting view of manliness. It certainly, the easy comparison is always to James Bond, and you know, he doesn't write really any James Bond type characters, but he does write specific types of men. And I don't know, Sam, what you think about John Le Carré's men just in general. How do they relate to that project? Not that coming at it from a specific direction.
That is a good question. I feel like I hadn't thought about that until you're asking me. Though that's silly that I hadn't, because
there's so many different types of men in his book, so it's hard to pick one. But right. The one thing I thought that you guys touched on a little bit, and this is something that maybe is maybe cross political in some ways, was he tends to have that British idolization, I think, to some degree, of that stoic individual, slavishly, you know, working for a cause that he believes in. But then he does poke holes in that and poke fun of that a lot too. So it's kind of a complicated view where it seems like he does generally admire those characteristics, but also realizes some of the absurdity inherent to that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think he's a writer of men, you know, I mean, it's sort of the classic critical take on him is that he doesn't write women characters very well. And he makes apologies for that in his own words. Mm-hmm. I wrote about it in both my pieces, I think. But, you know, he blames his mother who ran out on his family when he was like 4 years old. And he says something like, every time I try to write a woman character, Olive, it's mother's name, she gets in the way. It's probably not fair that I blame her for that, which is classic kind of Le Carré, like angry and self-indicting.
Totally.
But I think so that means that there are just many, many men, and there are many men in relationships of kind of dominance and submission with each other in terms of like superiors and their underlings, obviously fathers and sons, that I've written about this in my Baffler piece, that it's not just, the most autobiographical novel, A Perfect Spy, where there are these fathers and sons. Single is really like also exactly his. It's kind of like him imagining what would happen if his father was a much more effective con man than he was.
It's sitting on my nightstand right now, that book. So.
And Westerby's father in Honorable Schoolboy also a con man. Or some kind of, you know, there's some kind of tainted inheritance, tainted paternity there. So anyway, that's all in the mix. And then there's also this fraternity thing in his books, because these are books about men doing things together. Yeah. And, you know, I wrote about this in my Times piece that's one of the reasons I think Looking Glass War is so devastating and so effective, is because it's really about these men falling in love with each other and then sort of colluding in each other's self-deceptions about what they're doing, and sort of just having this tragic but very sincere sort of loving crusade together, which is like a break from, you know, this their sort of dull and ambiguous, ambivalent lives, both as like mid-century men, but also as sort of English civil servants in the Cold War era.
It has that kind of almost Friday Night Lights vibe to it, in the way of people who had this moment where they were it and everyone kind of was worshiping them. They're kind of past it and they want to recapture it, but instead of football, there's, you know, people's lives.
There's a deadly operation. Totally. So I do think he's critiquing what men are and what men do together, and how we, you know, leave men alone, leave sort of these supposedly like buttoned up Etonian Oxford educated bourgeois men in a room together, and they're going to plan a war, you know. It's this is what men do, and but in a but he's a satirist, so it's in a way that's really pathetic often. But he's too sympathetic towards his characters to make them look just totally stupid,
right? Like, and that's the important part, I think. Yeah,
yeah, he understands what they want, why they do the things they do, and then obviously there are masculine ideals in sort of archetypes. Like Smiley is a masculine ideal of a sort, and but it's this. Kind of, this is why he always says, and people always say that Smiley's the anti-Bond, because he's this sexless, dowdy, sort of donnish intellectual. He wanted to be, Smiley was going to be a priest, he wasn't doing spy hijinks, he'd be reading, Baroque, German literature.
Right.
And so there's great writing about kind of even his relationship with Lady Anne, that like him being a cuckold is kind of like essential to his character and to kind of this kind of sort of runaround evasion of the normal sicknesses of masculinity.
It's weird because he never really paints Anne as evil, which is also I find interesting. Like, he never judges it. It's presented very matter-of-factly, as far as I can remember, in a lot of the novels, that she's doing this, he's kind of accepted it. And I mean, that's kind of the one of the ending scenes. They really play it up in the movie, when I think that's the last scene, when Smiley gets back to his house and you just see the kind of silhouette of Anne sitting on the couch or whatever.
So there's
that's interesting.
There's the Smiley ideal, which is kind of like, the eunuch, in a way. The priest. I mean, I think also the thing about Smiley is he has no children, and we know nothing about his parents. So Smiley can be like an ideal father to the sons, the sort of his wayward sons,
to Gwillem
and to other young men in the service, because he's not really a father. I mean, it's really like he's a holy father. He's a priest in a way. He's their confessor. But there are people like Gwillem and the character that we're going to talk about in this book. What's his name? Alan Turner, who are much more like masculine, virile. Peter Gwillem is like, the main thing we know about him is, he's a good guy and he fucks around. He has a lot of women in his bed. So like, it is kind of funny that even when he has it both ways, in a way, like, I don't have a James Bond, like, but I do have a Peter Gwillem.
Or you have like a Jim Prideaux, who's kind of more manly man, but then kind of tragic in that way, because he followed through on the "I will do anything for duty" and then got shot and destroyed for it. So I think about that more now. I think after that conversation, I've been thinking about it a lot. So it was quite illuminating with respect to Le Carré, because he does, I think he captures a lot across the spectrum of men. And I do think that the Looking Glass War is a great, I think that is an interesting way to read the current concept of kind of a crisis of manliness, of people trying to recapture something that happened in the past, or a way of life that happened in the past, and some of the disastrous results that come from that. So it's worth thinking about. I was very provoked by that. So it was fortuitous timing.
And I think a good kind of example of how Smiley is sometimes held up to be this ideal is that in a lot of the Smiley books, he's not really in them a lot. It's just he's Looking Glass War. He kind of shows up at the end. Fire came in from the cold. He's kind of, he pops up again and again, and is, the competent savior, or not even savior
or not
Looking Glass War, but the hand of God in Looking Glass War and shutting the operation down. That he is like, it is still a Smiley book, because he is the epitome of what I guess you're trying to be.
He's everyone's
daddy. Even though everyone kind of fails to live up to it in many cases.
Very, very good stuff. So, so we're going to crack into a small town in Germany. So maybe before we dive into the plot, a couple bits of I don't know, interesting facts, I suppose. So it was the first book he wrote that didn't include George Smiley or The Circus, which I didn't realize that, but I guess due to date of publication, that makes sense. It was written in 68. So
well,
this was,
so
yeah.
I thought it didn't include The Circus at all, and it doesn't directly, but
yeah.
He, when Alan Turner shows up, they ask about, and it, this clicked to me the first time, Steed Asprey, who was the one who recruited Smiley to The Circus in...
Right.
I don't know if that is supposed to be, you know, actually the say it's taking person, place yeah. in the same universe, but yeah, it he at least drops that. But I don't know how purposeful. Well, it's probably purposeful, but I don't know. That is the only kind of connection.
Right, and it is set in Bonn, which, funny enough, I guess a Little Drummer Girl starts in. The initial bombing is in Bad Godesberg, I believe, which is one of the
yep.
Bonn suburbs where all the
yeah.
diplomats and everyone live. So there's some kind of connection throughout. And I believe, was am I making this up? Did he, when I'm talking about Cornwall, the man, he worked in Bonn, right? I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was, when he was in MI6, he was working under diplomatic cover. Right. In Bonn, which was at the time and in this novel the capital of the
Western Germany.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so which is interesting.
So this whole book that we're going to talk about is set in the British embassy
right
in West Germany, where Le Carré or David Cornwell worked. So you were just, I think right before it stopped, you were saying his description.
Of Bonn, just the way he describes it, it does feel that it's a description of someone who's clearly spent time there, especially things, he talks about the mist, how misty it is, how gray it is all the time. And he talks about the mist so often. Maybe the word that he uses in the entire book. It seems clear that that's, I don't know, part of at least what his lived experience was when he was working there. It seems that he has a great description of the buildings that they're in, the streets that they're in, the football fields that they're meeting people by. I don't know. And the hills, I think it's the Seven Hills or Five Hills or something outside of Bonn. It feels it just feels like a lived in place for him. So I really enjoyed that aspect of it. It seemed clear that he knew what he was talking about.
Yeah. I was looking up the last kind of the epilogue when at the rally at the end, I looked up like in Street View, where that town hall was, just to try to, and he did a great job of describing it. It's a very accurate description. You can tell it's someone who's been there a lot.
So basically the general plot, and we can kind of walk through it a bit and then give general thoughts, but it takes place in the late 60s. I don't think that it's ever, don't think a year is ever specifically described. But there's a few markers, maybe. I think he, oh my God, I'm forgetting his name now. The French president at the time.
De Gaulle?
Yeah, because De Gaulle, that's when he came back into office, I think was late 60s.
And I think it's late 60s because they say it's at least 20 years after the end of World War
II. Yeah, that's right. Actually, that 20 years after is a very important number.
40, it's like 66 to 68 when it was published, somewhere around then.
So effectively, the plot is it's almost a play. Or you probably could make a play out of this because it's 99% just guys sitting in rooms talking to each other. But most of it takes place in the British Embassy in Bonn. The backdrop, there's kind of two main parts of the backdrop. Great Britain's trying to get into the European common market. And to do so, they need support of the West German government. At the same time, there is this politician named Klaus Karfield, who, it's interesting that you had Carfield and Carla. I don't know if that's something that he did intentionally, but anyway, Klaus Carfield, who is kind of far right Nazi apologist, nationalist, who interestingly is very anti-Western, anti-British, and is trying to maybe make a case to turn towards the East, towards Eastern Europe, towards maybe communist allies, which that's a question I had, because, you know, this isn't something, the history of this period in Germany isn't something that I'm super familiar with, but was that idea of a nationalist German party turning towards kind of a communist bloc, was that real? That seemed kind of bizarre to me, that's would be the setup, but
I don't know.
But anyway,
I don't know. It seemed more to me, if it was more kind of seemed like a parallel to the Molotov-Ribbentrop, where the Nazis right. kind of turned towards the Soviets before, while they invaded the West and then turned on the Soviets. Right. I don't know if that was kind of what clicked, what was in my head, was that it didn't seem like he really wanted to be
right.
with the East. It was more as a weapon against
an ally of convenience.
Yeah.
Type of idea. Yeah. So those are the two things in the background going on. So the British embassy is in some amount of chaos. As this is happening, there is a low level diplomatic staff who is effectively been a temporary staff for years named Leo Harding. And he is an organist with their church choir. He is a quiet guy that, at least at the beginning of the book, it seems that no one really knows much about or cares too much about. He goes missing. When they find out he's missing, they also find out that a whole bunch of files, including a very, very important file at the embassy, are also missing. So they contact the British Foreign Office, and the British Foreign Office sends over Alan Turner, who is kind of our protagonist in the book. And Alan Turner arrives to find Leo Harding and hopefully recover the missing files. That's the main thrust of it. So, you know, maybe without walking, the funny thing about it is it's actually relatively straightforward in terms of it's Leo Harding's investigation. He interviews a whole bunch of people in the embassy. He finds out more about Leo Harding's life and tries to track down where he is. That part of it's all quite straightforward. And then we have some twists near the end, which we can get into. But maybe just taking, let's say, the first almost two-thirds of the book, where it's just Turner arriving, talking to people, learning about Leo Harding and his life and how he's become very mixed up in a lot of people's lives there. Is there anything that stuck out or that you wanted to pick out that was interesting, chapters or specific characters that you thought were worth noting?
Well, I was interested to read something from Le Carré's prologue that he added to it when it was republished
right.
in 1991.
Right.
Those introductions that are in the later editions of the book.
Yes.
Where in this one, it's funny, his attitude towards it was that he thought that it was really a failure, and then when he went back and read it, he realized that actually I kind of did what I set out to do. I think it wasn't as well received at the time as the books that had come just before it, which I'd be interested to talk about maybe later on why that might be, especially
yeah.
in terms of what the twists are.
What
he does say, which I think is really true and profound and something that I had a inchoate sense of when I was reading it for the first time, but he really put it well, is he says, he basically describes the book as a ghost story, like almost like a Victorian ghost story. He says, the ghost, of course, is Leo Harding. Alan Turner is his exorcist. Raleigh Bradfield, who's the head of chancery, like the political right. liaison at the embassy. Raleigh Bradford, he writes, is the luckless owner of the haunted house.
It is a perfect description. It really is great.
And so when you think about it in that way, it's like Alan Turner is kind of coming into this weird place of the embassy. I mean, it's normal and it's boring in many respects,
yeah,
but there are these things that don't make sense. You know,
yeah,
why do people seem evasive about certain topics? Why do people seem scared? Why are there these missing objects? You know, yeah, in addition to the missing files, like, why is this fan missing? Why is, yeah, this chair missing? There's
what's
this,
with
this
the
kind
hair dryers?
Of, yeah, the, what's up with the hair dryers? Why is everybody giving each other hair dryers? And it's like, like, there's this, that feeling when you read, like, the beginning of, like, Wuthering Heights or something, where, like, you're kind of in this world and you're like, is there something really deeply wrong here? I can't, mm-hmm, put my finger on it, but what is it? And it's his kind of job to kind of figure out what any of this means, if anything, yeah, and try to find this ghost. And I think the other reason that it's an effective metaphor, too, is just because ultimately we're talking about disinterring, like, ghosts from the past,
yeah, yes,
that really both the West German government and the British are haunted by and really want to keep
buried,
underground,
so to speak,
and, yeah, then, mm-hmm, buried, and then, and of course, like, ultimately, as we'll talk about, like, mm-hmm, there ultimately is even a, like, architectural element to this, because we find out that that Harding has been hiding underground, like, literally,
right, literally
below,
yeah,
below the embassy. I think that's definitely one way to think about it, though. Yeah, I think you're right too, that it would work really well as just like a play in a series of rooms,
yeah,
because really what we're getting here is Alan Turner, who, his character is interesting. I mentioned he's a little bit more of the, like, strapping,
yeah,
Jerry Westerby type,
take control
of Le
the situation.
Yeah, yeah, like, use
lot,
more like he's really brutal, you know,
yeah,
like his way of talking to people, and he's quick to anger, and he's almost kind of like bewilderingly brutal at first.
Well, and there's also one of the really interesting parts in that series of interviews he gives, because I think one of the first chapters, and I can't remember the last name of the guy, but he is the registry's head, so he's in control of all the files. He has a daughter called Myra, and one of the early chapters, he's talking to a colleague about, you know, Myra's doing better, but she's still struggling, and it's clear that she has a mental affliction or issue,
yeah,
of some kind. And then you find out that actually the reason for this was Turner had effectively interrogated her in Poland, I believe, Warsaw.
It's
maybe?
In, yeah, Warsaw, yeah.
And she had been involved in something where maybe someone she was dating was actually a spy or something.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
he brutally interrogated her to the point where it seems like he effectively broke her. And,
caused her to miscarry. She was
right,
caused her,
right,
to miscarry.
So really brutal. So it's kind of an interesting way to set him up, because in some respects you kind of think of him as the hero in some way, or he's presented as the protagonist, but he is an asshole and he's obviously done something horrible to someone, clearly, who wasn't invested in what she was doing.
Yeah.
She was just an innocent.
He's cruel, and it's kind of like what's one of the effective things about the novel is that, like, you kind of only come to, it's almost like the story is about Alan Turner finding a reason, a, mm-hmm, justification for his brutality, like, for his,
yes,
anger. Because in the end, he's right to be brutal to these people, mm-hmm, not to,
yes,
this young woman, but to his sort of interrogate.
But for
his,
a different reason than he kind of realized, than he thought.
Like, for,
right,
a completely different,
yeah,
reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's just that it's almost like we're kind of like, why is this person so brutal? Does he have any reason to be? And then by the end, you're like, yes, these people are deserving of this brutality,
yeah,
just not for the reason he was,
right,
he was meting it out.
Well, and he also gets the classic Le Carré treatment, where one of the first things we learn about him is his wife has effectively been sleeping with someone else and has kind of left him, is living at her sister's house, I think.
Yeah.
And that's basically the first character detail we learn about him.
Everyone asks him if he's married. It's like the thing everyone asks him throughout the book is, are you,
yeah,
married?
Yeah, exactly. So
it's
Smiley's
colleagues being like, and how's Anne?
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. So he I think you get, it's kind of a nice, it's not that it's a red herring. It explains there's some very big segments that are just in Turner's mind as he's trying to process information, and he keeps kind of paralleling his wife's affair with, I think the guy's name is Tony, and then what's happening in real life and overlaying those things. So it's clearly something that is a big part of his character. But
and they, yeah, and Leo's failed marriage, or you know, failed engagement to Margaret. That's throughout the entire book.
Yeah, and I really, you know, the part where I felt most like a play was those. I think there's four or maybe five chapters that are just titled. The chapter titles are the person he's talking to or interrogating.
Yes,
and it's kind of a weird interrogation because he's not interrogating an enemy, quote unquote. He's interrogating other British political people, and they are all kind of trying to, it's very clear as he's talking to them that people are hiding certain things. So he's not getting a full picture of who exactly Leo was, or he's trying to, and he does. And the way the book's written is you're led into the view that people think Leo has defected to the Russians. And that he has stolen a bunch of important documents from the embassy that is maybe meant to mess up the British entry into this common market. That's kind of the theory that it seems that everyone initially has. Although as you learn more, I think it's obvious that especially Raleigh did not think that the whole time.
I think that's definitely what Turner thought. Yeah. I think it's what Bradfield and maybe probably just Bradfield was trying to keep him on that track.
Right. And then the other interesting, go ahead, Max. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was just going to say, I don't think even Bradfield knew what he was actually up to.
Not entirely, not until the end. Because Bradfield, when he gets the big reveal, does seem genuinely shocked about what he's learning. And I guess the other pretty key character, although he's not in a lot of scenes, but is very effective. This is the one guy who almost could be in a Bond movie. Was I can't remember how to pronounce his name. Siebkron?
Delisle. Siebkron.
Siebkron. Yeah.
Siebkron. He's kind of the German minister.
He's like Carla. He's very Carla-esque in having his hands and everything.
Head of internal security, and he effectively, as this is all happening, one of the other backdrop pieces is there's Carfield is doing all these demonstrations across Western Germany, and they're turning up these huge crowds that are very aggressive. They're rioting. They actually kill a librarian, which maybe we'll touch on in a minute, which turns out to be relatively important. So he's stirring up a lot of security issues, and he's very anti-British. So Siebkron early, which seems like he's doing a nice thing, although the embassy doesn't like it, is basically putting them on lockdown and not allowing them to go out without being, you know, having a security escort. They have to spend a lot more time at the embassy than they otherwise would like to. And he's quite an interesting figure as well. And he more than any of them comes across as kind of the stereotypical ex-Nazi German political guy, very severe, very brutal, very cunning. But I thought he was a well done character too. Kind of he a fun little bad guy.
I think also just in terms of, you know, what people think about what we learn that people think about Leo from the interrogations, or the kind of impression you get as a reader of who he is, because at first it's sort of like he's an unimportant, eccentric who's been around for a long time. Then it becomes sort of clear that actually he's kind of essential, you know, like
he's competent.
They try to, a lot of people try to downplay who he is, but he does have diplomatic status, and like there's, you know, he is a diplomat. He has immunity. When Turner ends up talking to kind of the non-diplomats, they all, you know, they kind of hold him in regard in a certain sense.
Right. He's from, a higher floor at that time. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, this is maybe we can just turn to the ending now.
Spoilers.
But because I think what might be going on too, or it becomes clear that might be going on in those earlier chapters, once we know more about Leo later on, is that first of all, he's foreign. He's not English.
Yep.
I forget where he's from. Somewhere.
Sure. He's German. Eastern Bloc. Isn't he?
Oh, he's German.
He is German. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And He's Jewish, right?
He's Jewish. Half Jewish. Yeah, he's Jewish.
Or at least so, half. Or at least half.
At least half, half. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, I mean, that becomes really important for the ending, which we'll talk about now, but, like, I think that's also partly what may explain some of the weird ways that everyone's talking about him throughout the whole thing. It's like, how is this guy, like, this, like, kind of, you know, kind of described as this unimportant, like, mousy outsider, but also, like, powerful and part of this conspiracy that has, it's like classic kind of
Jewish tropes.
It's anti-Semitic conspiracy theory where they can both be the small unimportant person and also the kind of the person with all the power, the grand mastermind, and just kind of how people are just weird when they're talking about him. It's just later on when you know this, these are mid-century English people. They're anti-Semitic. Yeah. I mean, they're just like normal kind of anti-Semitism, not like you know Nazis. It turns
out they're anti-Semitic.
Not that far away, unfortunately. And I think there's an interesting thing too that parallels kind of, especially during the war, because they do talk about one of the things at first. What you hear about Leo's background is he was kind of a nothing guy. He emigrated to the UK. He went to some sort of farm school, which I'm not sure if that was a euphemism for some sort of diplomatic training school. I don't know. But he kind of bumbled around. He had an uncle there, but not much family. And then what you find out later, and then during kind of the post-war denazification, the story was that he was basically this low-level guy that was settling claims. Someone would say, oh, like a Nazi broke my barn, so can you pay me or whatever. And he seemed very important. What you learn later is he was actually a Nazi hunter. He was making cases. Yeah. And I think actually they said, and it's in the Wikipedia article, he was based on Simon Wiesenthal, which I didn't know that name initially, but there's been quite a few movies and TV shows based around him, who is a very prominent Nazi hunter, who I think his team had a part in locating Adolf Eichmann. Later in life, which is interesting. So he was building up cases against ex-Nazis who, you know, had escaped or gone under the radar in some way and trying to persecute them as part of denazification. And which is a really interesting turn, because then all of a sudden his competence and abilities really gets flipped on its head. And it starts lining up much more with the picture that people are painting of him. He's not some rube. He's like incredibly intelligent guy.
So can I ask you guys a question?
Yeah.
What did you see the twist coming? We'll tell the listeners what the twist is.
Yeah, I absolutely
did. Go ahead.
I say no. I'm very bad at picking up twists. So no.
I thought something was coming, but I honestly thought it was it'll be more along the lines of maybe he was Russian, but it turned out that he was actually a double agent or something for the British. I thought it was going to be one of those things, which Le Carré has kind of done similar things before.
Just from knowing it's Le Carré, I knew it wasn't just going to be like straightforward.
He's a Russian spy.
Spy. He did it, whatever. Yeah, but I did not know. I didn't see what.
What about you, Sam?
I had an inkling when the stuff with the token, the little
the buttons.
But I didn't. That's so moving when you learn about it later that it turns out it was effectively from it was kind of currency within a concentration camp. Is that effectively what we were talking about there?
I think so.
They were using buttons from like their garments that they were given to use.
But basically what you learn before you know that is that like Leo would go out drinking and he would refuse to pay and then put down this button as his payment and then get into fights with like, you know, kind of like what are effectively like jackbooted thugs in bars, Germans. And it was kind of bewildering, you know, to Turner and to the people who saw it, like what was going on. And at that point I started to think, okay, he might be a Jew. And that's kind of this sort of like, it's like the twist is the guy who seems like maybe he hates Germans and because he's a communist or like is involved in some kind of secret plot. He's a communist. No, he's involved in a secret plot because he's Jewish and he's trying, you know, to give it away. He's trying to revive the case that he was made to abandon against Karfeldt, the guy who's the nationalist politician with the Nazi ties, who it turns out he's an industrialist now.
Mm-hmm. A chemical manufacturer.
Yeah, and it turns out that he was doing chemical experiments on Jews during the war. Mm-hmm. And that's and
specifically
what,
half Jews, which is an interesting thing.
I think they made
a really specific reference to the fact that they called what I can't remember the term that they used.
Hybrids,
which meant half Jews. And there was a small town in Germany, another small town in Germany that they were kind of had this factory, and they were brought in kind of a bus of 31 people. And then later on, when they were excavating after the war for some other reason, they found 32 bodies, one of which they think was basically a local who kind of figured something out and then was shot. Yeah.
And so Harding had been investigating this. Then he was made to, you know, basically stop. I don't really remember the details of why he had to stop.
I think it was they were handing over. It was like the handover from.
Oh, yeah.
From England to the occupation. The occupation was ending. And they said, well, we don't have enough proof because he didn't admit anything in interrogation. The Germans, this was a
Eastern Front was his story.
Yes.
And one of the things was they were trying to disprove that, and that was proving to be challenging.
And this was in real life a big thing. Like there was the big Nuremberg trials and there were prosecutions, but Germany for a long time just kind of, you know, okay, we got Hitler, we got Goering, we got all the big guys. Like we can ignore all the people who are actually on the ground, you know, actually doing the killing.
And also, this is a moment in the 60s where West Germany, the political apparatus and the industrial world are filled with ex-Nazis, the people that they know are ex-Nazis, right?
Who are the US, the US too. Like we're going to the moon on the back of Nazis.
Right. And it's in the same sort of justification in some cases because we need their expertise. We can't just get rid of these people, especially now that we're at war, in a Cold War. We need to compete with the East. We need to keep our Nazis around, our competent bureaucrats who are just happen to be former Nazis. And that was a really I think that for understanding what Le Carré was getting at in this book too, just more broadly, that was something that I think was revolting and frustrating to him about working in Bonn, was just seeing that we're on these people's side now, you know, these are our good Germans, but I know that guy and that guy and that guy were all Nazis and now they're our best friends. And the English, what the novel does implicate the English very much
100%.
in kind of covering these things up and kind of, you know, just out of a sense of prudence, ignoring.
It's not cricket anymore to keep persecuting them 20 years later. It's not right. It's not proper to keep doing that. And
we need them and we need to keep this relationship good and we need to get into the common market and blah, blah, blah. And so Leo is kind of like this surrogate figure who is just wants to get to the bottom of it and is using all the resources of the embassy. The files that are missing are just all these files about Karfeldt and about his relationship with the Nazis, but also about I kind of understood it to be not just like he is reinvestigating the case against Karfeldt, but it also kind of felt like he's looking kind of at the whole social system.
The failed prosecutions, the failure to kind of actually do anything to dismantle what was the root of the problem.
And failed, but capped.
Because
that's one of the big things is there's this time cap of, I think it's 20 years is I believe what it was, where if they didn't have effectively a trial started by 20 years after the end of the war, and they said that date moved around a little bit, then too bad. And so one of the big characters is this, I can't remember his name now, starts with a P,
Prochko,
who is this friend of Leo's who he went to England with.
I think he is supposed to be Jewish too.
I think so.
He mentioned changing his name to Prochko.
Yeah.
But even he is like teaming up with Karfeld.
Well, yeah, exactly. He's like a political hack, effectively, and he's writing speeches for Karfeld now. And he's basically told Leo the last time they met that, like, sorry, the statute of limitations is up, which is such a bizarre phrase. That's a phrase you hear just generally in life now, and to apply that phrase to Nazis is so bizarre.
Nazi war criminals
who are gassing people to death and, you know, torturing people, and so yeah, and Leo basically had this realization of kind of a year before this starts that he's running out of time. He has to try and do something now. Turns out he's kind of already out of time, and he actually, which is interesting, there's this scene with the library. It's the British library, I think, which isn't actually British, but it was some, you know, sponsored by British people or whatever. This librarian is killed and no one understands why. No one can figure out why the crowd actually rushed this library. And then it turns out the librarian, I believe she was...
His ex-fiance.
And Leo was in there and tried to kill Karfeld, and the gunshot and the attempted assassination was what kind of set the crowd off. Leo got away, but his ex-fiance was killed. So that was another interesting twist that I didn't really see coming.
Well, and you finally find out that the first chapter of the book is Leo chasing after Karfeld after when he's coming out of a meeting with Bradfield.
Which is an interesting wrap up point.
I think the thing that really, I mean, we should just describe the end of the book in a second, the very end, but I found the kind of, Leo's bunker, like underground in the embassy, which I mentioned earlier, but that's where he's got like the map of the little town where these experiments were taking place, and all the files are there, and the missing lamp is there, and he's just been building a little office for himself to do this work underground. Like, I felt that was like a really like powerful, because that's where Turner kind of discovers what's actually going on here. Is when he sees this place that's hidden away, but it also sort of like reminds me of something that Le Carré often has a preoccupation with, is like this idea that there's some place where the whole truth of everything can be found, you know, in a perfect spy. There's this file cabinet that his father carts around with him everywhere he goes. And the son is convinced that like the whole truth of his life is somewhere in there, you know. Mm-hmm. and then there's he also has the burn box, which is supposedly has like all the, you know, secrets of that he may sell to, you know, or give away to the East. But there's always these there's often this idea that like somewhere with enough time and enough information, like and you know, enough kind of know-how and determination, you could figure it all out. You could sort the world into right and wrong, and make end this kind of moral gray, which is the kind of universe of Le Carré's novels, right? The characters who want to do this are usually tragic figures. They can't do it, you know, but they want to do it, and they're usually admirable for wanting to do it, or at least we as the reader sympathize with them for wanting to do it. And I feel like as much as any other book that has a moment like this, like that bunker where Leo is doing his work, really felt like, you know, it's tragic because we know he's gone. He hasn't been able to do it. He's probably off trying to kill Karfeld again. But there's something heroic about the effort and the desire to like really sort out who's the good guys and who are the bad guys and make everything right.
And I feel like every novel has someone like that, I think Prideaux is another one that's in that category where he's kind
absolutely.
Of...
Absolutely.
It's like Prideaux, you know, controls like, you got to trust me. If we do this thing, if you go on this mission and we accomplish this, we've got it. Like, we'll get them all. We'll figure this out. We'll be back in charge of the circus. Everything will be right again. and inevitably just people who have maybe a more clear moral view of the world get destroyed by the system of people who are dedicated to the grayness. And that's, you know, so the ending, right, we kind of, Turner finds this office. He finally puts it all together. And you can see Turner's had this change of heart too when he meets with Bradfield, and he kind of lays it all out to Bradfield and basically is imploring Bradfield, you have to help me find him. If Cibachron finds him, and we find out Cibachron is effectively working for Carfield, protecting him. He wants him to win. If he finds him first, he's dead. So we got to find him. Even if he's in trouble and he's in jail in Britain for the rest of his life, we have to save this guy. He's doing the right thing. You know, like, you have to agree with me that he's doing the right thing. They end up going to this rally that Carfield is having. That's we've been leading up to. He's built this big structure to give a speech on.
And Bradfield, at least, I don't know if he's, I couldn't tell if he's lying to Turner or at least, or actually thinks, but it says, oh, Cibachron is going to, they're going to hand him over to us.
He thinks,
at least that's what he's telling Turner.
Yeah. That,
you know, we're going to find Harding. They're going to hand him over to us and we're going to get him out of the country.
Yeah. And so there's this idea that he's probably going to make another attempt to kill Carfield at this big rally. So they show up to the rally, Bradfield, Turner, and Delise, who we haven't talked about, but I love Delise's character. I thought he was really funny. Le Carre obviously is great comedic writer, and Delise had so many great lines. But so the three of them show up at this rally as Carfield is giving this speech, and it's quite interesting how it's intercut with Turner desperately trying to find Leo. And as you are getting Carfield's speech, which is, you know, effectively Nazi apologia throughout, right? He's like, yeah, it was bad, but everyone's done bad things. It's like, they can't hold this over us for together forever.
It's very well done the way, it's just, the book is really well written. And I found the way that he presented the speech to be one of those great moments for him.
Oh, so cinematic.
He doesn't just give you the text of the speech, like as one, you know, quotation. He describes the way he's going about making the arguments. And the effect of that is it feels more suspenseful than if he just were reading the speech. You know, he sort of said, and then he moved on to, you know, talking about how, well, the British did this in colonial Africa. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, and like he kind of does this thing where you kind of, it's like, the mechanics of the speech are being described, and then you get to the end and you hear some of the actual specifics of it, and it becomes less sophisticated and more blood, you know, blood
base.
Soil.
Yeah,
know,
exactly.
Yeah, base. But yeah. I just remember, cause and that's the same time that you're having this cinematic thing where where Turner's trying to find, Harding, and,
it and really then there's is this interesting moment where this kind of socialist group shows up, waving a red flag, kind of protesting it, and there's this thought of, oh,
it's Antifa.
It's true. This is like a false flag Antifa to kind of draw the attention, make a bit of chaos, because they think that's when Harding is going to strike, which inevitably that is exactly what happens. And then you have this tragic moment where Turner is running up and he sees Leo on the ground dead,
which is also very similar to the ending of Spy Who Came In From the Cold.
Even with the like, I know he's Lamas is a wall, but there's a scaffolding kind of height element that's interesting. And so it's kind of funny. So then there's this epilogue, which is pretty long, but part of me wishes that was just it and there was no epilogue. Like that.
That is the epilogue.
You're right.
That is the epilogue.
Because when does it? When does that,
it ends right at
the last? The last line is like them searching his pockets.
Yeah. Last chapter that's not the epilogue is them talking to Prochko. I think is
right. Maybe that's right.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. So
I don't know. I don't know. I don't
correctly.
I think he calls it a prologue and epilogue just because it's the only scenes Leo is actually in. In the entire book.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. That's totally right. And that's actually one of the cool parts just in terms of how the way the book is written is that Leo and Alan never meet.
No.
So Alan's learning about Leo this whole time and the reader is, and you're learning a lot about him. And the whole thing is basically Leo's story, but you're seeing it through Turner. And the only time when they finally meet is right at the end when he's been killed by, you know, Sieber Kron's thug. So I found it was very moving. I actually thought this was, for me, I found it more affecting than a lot of novels. I don't know if and I don't think it's just the subject matter. I think when it turns from Cold War West versus East to Nazi British cover up of Nazi former Nazis, it takes such a dramatic turn too in terms of the morality at play. And then maybe the biggest, most important scene is that argument right at the end between Turner and Bradfield, where Turner's just imploring Bradfield, like, you have to acknowledge that this is fucked up what we're doing. And Bradfield, it kind of turns on that this is real politique. You don't understand. We can't be mad at these people forever. We have to move on. You know, I don't believe in anything. I just come show up to work and do my job and hope for the best. And that exchange is pretty devastating too.
But there's also sort of this implication that Turner has and Leo are like alike. They both have some kind of thing
drive
that makes them ill suited to the world that they're operating in, which I think is interesting because you wouldn't think that at the beginning of the book.
So I think wanted to bring it back to your Times article where you had placed this as the, I guess I can't remember exactly it, but as the most apt for modern times. And this is my first time reading this since kind of it's very apt for the US, but even particularly for the German with the rise of
right now
AFD, which is, I guess I think just recently polled the highest out of any party in Germany right now. And then, I don't know if it was another, there's a New York Times podcast a few years ago called Day X about the kind of,
I thought about that a lot.
Neo-Nazis in the German military. I guess Sam wanted to get your thoughts on that. Just kind of expanded on what was in the article.
Well, I mean, I'll be honest with you guys is that I kind of like, I had to come up with like ways to shoehorn each of the
books. Sure. Of course.
Into the of kind course. Of like,
Yeah.
The premise, the kind of structure of these essential guides. But I mean, I did think that because Le Carré is usually talking about the kind of competing moralities of East and West in the Cold War conflict, you know, where usually he's coming down on the side of like, you know, they use the same tactics towards different ideological ends. And sometimes he seems more sympathetic to even socialism than capitalism. And sometimes he's a little bit more patriotic. And I think it's interesting to track that throughout his work too, but that's another podcast. But I think he doesn't write about fascists very often. So I think, it's really, except for when there's this kind of British nostalgia for the just war that they won and were heroes in. But even then, they're not really talking about Nazis or Nazi ideology.
No.
And I think that, like, I think that there's an undercurrent in his books of the idea that, like, the post-war era is one in which you know, English society in particular is adapting itself to moral gray, like that we refer to. It's usually an indictment of just kind of like, you know, means, the ends justifying the means, or like an indictment of kind of English sort of self-importance and myopia. Here,
like, we'll do whatever we can just to keep a fraction of what we had before the war, kind of.
I think what makes this book such a gut punch is that, like, he's showing that, like, one of the things that, like, that English myopia and sort of self-deceiving and kind of like, you know, moral narcissism can evade is like culpability for the worst possible thing. that anybody ever did. you know?
Right.
So like, I feel like the kind of like what's being repressed in the English personality in all of the books is not usually as damningly named as culpability in the greatest crimes in human history.
Yeah, because right? I think often, like you said, A Spy Who Came In From the Cold does this a lot, where he kind of, you know, Lamas kind of has some sympathies for the Soviets, but then ultimately the realization is, you know, even though I might maybe agree with some of the moral landscape you're trying to achieve, you're going about it the exact same way we are. And the people who are kind of at the top, and because there's even, there's some ex-Nazi stuff mixed up in some of those.
That's true. No, I was just thinking that as you were saying that, because Fiedler's Jewish.
Yes.
What's
his name? Yeah.
I'm blanking.
The other.
Munt.
Yeah.
The one who's actually on the English side is the Nazi.
That's kind of like the same story here.
Yeah.
Right, that we're talking about here. In terms of like geopolitical terms, this is like well-placed former Nazi that needs to be protected for British imperatives and a Jew who's being thrown under the bus to protect him. It's just that like in that case, it's kind of like that is what characterizes these characters. They're not really talked. This is a book where like the crimes of the Holocaust are the crime. That is being covered up.
I think this one hit me more. That revelation hit me more in this book than in that book. That was kind of not that it was a side story. It was kind of the justification for the ending in that book. Whereas this was more central to the story, and I found it much more affecting that turn, in this book at least. I think it really was. There's a lot of his books that I love reading, and some of them I find impactful or have moments of impact. This was one of the ones that I truly throughout. There was an anxiety I felt the whole time. That I think was Turner's anxiety as well, of just what is going on? What am I missing? And people having this relationship of, no, Leo's actually an amazing guy, but we don't really understand him. No one really knows him. And that revelation just hit me like a ton of bricks. And maybe just to wrap up here, overall thoughts, and I'll go first just because I'm already talking. I honestly think this right when I finished reading, I thought this might be my favorite Le Carré book. It was such a good mix. There's laugh out loud moments for me, which for reading is always something I find is rare. It had very interesting characters. It was kind of a good little mystery along the way, but then it grappled, I thought, very well with some very challenging ideas. The twist was one I absolutely did not see coming, and I think makes it quite a bit different than a lot of his other twists. Even though it shadows Spy Who Came In From the Cold a little bit. I loved it, and I'm super glad that we ended up reading it, because like many of his smaller quote-unquote works, it's so easy to be like, I'll get to that one day, it's probably fine, and then you read them and it's kind of a treasure trove. So I really love this book. Mm-hmm. Sam, what do you think?
I was going to let Max go.
The structure of the book, I really loved it. It really reminds me, kind of going back to A Murder of Quality and Call from the Dead, it is kind of a reverse murder mystery, in that the murder happens at the end. But he is a detective. And I think this is the first time it kind of clicked for me that I kind of noticed that many of Le Carré's books are counterintelligence novels. They're not really spy. He's not following like a spy spying. He's following spy catchers most of the time. Mm-hmm. And that kind of, I think, is where he is pulling that from, kind of the murder mystery structure, is that it gives a very big push to the book of like, oh, what are we going to find next?
Right.
I think this affected me more this time. After reading it after Trump was elected, the Trump presidency, and just with the rise of AFD, and as a Jewish person, mm-hmm. who, you know, definitely has sometimes thought that kind of claims from certain people in the media of anti-Semitism are overblown, that, you know, it's kind of the right wing. The right wing uses it for, you know, to protect, you know, to try to protect themselves or to protect Israel, things like that. But, you know, that they're really kind of, you do see a rise in this, that this, it was, you can see, I think Le Carre had is very good at getting his finger on kind of the pulse and what the issues are. And it kind of really hit me more this time than it did the first time I read it.
Yeah, I think so too. I do. I think to agree with what you're saying, Max, that like the Karfeldt movement is really just in the background of this book.
Yes.
Yeah. And what's so effective about it in its like plot structure is that like it turns out that's the whole story. It's all about.
Yeah.
It. You don't think that when you're reading it.
No.
I think one of the things about like whether in a book or like living in a time where there's some kind of like political crisis, like kind of in the background of your life, and you kind of feel like it's causing, there's some kind of ambient noise, or like every once in a while you are reminded, oh, that's going on. But otherwise you're living your life, the plot of your life moves on. Like the book does such a really good job of kind of generating that feeling of like, there's something out there, there's some storm brewing, or there's something wrong out there. It might have something to do with me. It might have something, you know, like the feeling you're describing, Max, of like being like, usually it's overblown when they talk about anti-Semitism, like, the right uses it in a bad faith way to protect themselves, blah, blah, blah. But then like this novel is like, okay, but what if it is about you?
Yes.
what if it's actually the whole story, you know, and at the end of it, you know, something devastating is going to happen. I feel like he does such a good job of just creating that dual, that kind of feeling, like.
That's what it is. It's that
dread. There's a feeling of dread throughout the book.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's not just the end. That's the part that I loved about it, is I that sense of dread, it throughout the whole book, it really felt like a horror novel in some ways.
Yeah.
That was maybe a bit different to some of his books, that just an unease. And, you know, even it's funny, it's the little things, the hair dryers. I kept thinking, okay, is he putting listening devices in the hair dryers? What the hell is going on with them? And then the button too. It's like, what the fuck are these buttons?
What is this?
It's just like, what is going on? What am I missing? And to your point, I think that's it. It's such an easy thing to reach to. It's like, oh, this is the Trump thing or whatever. But I mean, he wrote this in the 60s. It feels like he wrote this yesterday, right? Like if he wrote this exact book yesterday, everyone would say, wow, this is such a great, you know, encapsulation of our current moment or whatever, right? But it does feel that way. In a very non-cliche way, and it felt scary and moving, and so much of his stuff is Russia, England, and the Nazi element heightens it to some extent. But I think the reason that it's heightened is the juxtaposition of the British embassy's culpability in it.
Yeah,
it's not just the evil Germans have outwitted us. It's like we've allowed them to win, basically, or we don't care if they win.
It was
great. Really, really good book. And thanks, Sam, because this is your suggestion too. So I really appreciate that you suggested this, because when we would have gotten to this, I don't know. We're both dads with several children, and it takes us a long time to read and to record episodes. So I'm really glad we got to this now, because I'll be thinking about it for a long time. So just to wrap up, Sam Adler-Bell, thanks so much for being here and taking the time.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. This was fun.
Yeah, super, super fun to have you. A big fan of your work. So like we said, read Sam's pieces on John Le Carre, but on everything.
And everything, yes.
Sam's just a really good writer. and definitely check out Know Your Enemy, a podcast I've been listening to for a long time now. And I think it's when you listen to that pod and read John Le Carre, oh, yeah, that's where the magic happens. A lot of good stuff happening there. So thanks, Sam. I really appreciate you being on.
Thanks, guys. This was really great.
Awesome. Okay. Thanks, everybody. We will probably be out with another episode in anywhere between 1 and 6 months. But in the meantime, appreciate you listening, and we'll talk to you later. Bye.